media and public opinion during the Vietnam War. All right, this is lecture number 24, which if you will look at the note at the bottom here indicates why it's out of sync. I'll be out of town next Thursday. We have this meeting with the Russians from the Institute of Oriental Studies in Moscow. Or we go there, they come here. We've done this 9 times. And when this was scheduled last year, it was scheduled for it to be held in Berkeley. And instead, they have moved it to Monterey. So I thought class began that I'd be in town. But now I've got to meet 15 Russians at SFO and escort them to Monterey. So what I have done is switch this field trip, so-called, to next Thursday. And this is simply, there will be no class, and if you want to come down to the archive and work, you can, but you don't have to. So, I don't have my original schedule here, but there are 3 in this so-called war in and outside of the Beltway. Really 3 lectures that deal with the war outside of Vietnam. And they can really be taken in any particular order. War inside the Beltway is the war is viewed and conducted from Washington. That's the Beltway is the Beltway that runs around Washington. How it was seen in Congress, in the White House, State Department, other branches of the executive, parts of the executive branch. Also, the relationship here is with U.S. foreign policy, the NATO alliance, and Europe, and Japan. Outside the Beltway, then, is really in 2 parts. One of it deals with the mass media public opinion. The other deals with the anti-war movement and the sort of general attitudes of Americans toward the war, veterans, and so on. So what we have here today is the 1/3 that deals with the mass media and public opinion. I'm not sure I can get through all of this, but I'll go as far as I can. I guess the text from my sermon was Lyndon Johnson's observation on public opinion in the U.S. that it was the essential domino. And when it fell, so did he. I'm not terribly knowledgeable about this, as you probably know. I spent almost 15 years outside of the country, and I didn't see this phenomenon up close in the United States, except on very occasional trips back here. It's what I think historians and others have come to call the Cultural Revolution, or the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, sort of a spin-off from what happened in China. I was struck at the time in coming back. This is the 1960s. I think I came back here at least once a year for the whole period. I was back for a whole year or 9 months in 63 and 4. I was at MIT. And I was very much aware of this cultural revolution in the United States. More so, I think, because if you're outside of a country and you visit it only occasionally and you know it fairly well, the changes are much more stark. They hit you a lot more than if you live there and you see them sort of developing day to day. The major elements of this cultural revolution, as far as I was concerned, I don't think this is too typical, but the thing that made the greatest impact on me and that I thought would have the most lasting effect was the change in gender relations. It really did change phenomenally. And I don't have any sisters, so the woman I thought most of in these terms was my mother. And how she was, and how her life was, and the life of her friends, and she had been a school teacher and a professional when she was young, and then went back to teaching after I left home, and she didn't have anything else to do. And I just always felt women got a kind of raw deal, and it didn't bother me too much, of course, being a man. But I was really struck as I came back at how this gender relationship had really changed. And I really thought when the history of the 60s is written, that's what historians are going to focus on, much more than the other phenomena. I'm not so sure anymore, but for what it's worth, that was my sort of personal impression. The second most dominant element, really, as far as I was concerned, of this cultural revolution had to do with race relations, with the Southern sit-ins, the Selma story, the bus desegregation efforts, the Supreme Court decisions on voting and education, schools, the Kennedy years. These really put the stake in the heart of segregation in this country, and it also brought home, I think, to all of us that this was not just a Southern problem. This is what we Northern liberals in the early years used to think it was. Third was the age element. Don't trust anyone over 30. I put this down primarily as a failure by adults and a failure by adult leadership. Clearly it was a revolution in which the young were in the vanguard. They were making changes that needed to be made, I think, for the most part, but they were not being counseled as they should have been by their elders. Ironically, of course, the vanguard of this effort was the 80-year-olds, 80-year-old Mao Zedong, 80-year-old Bertrand Russell, others, Franz Fanon, the Algerian shrink, Herbert Marcuse, Dr. Spock. I don't know what that means exactly, why there was that gulf, but I think it's a fact. Fourth, it was a revolution in mores, in cultural values, in the proper order of things, priorities. These involving politics, and ecology, environment, economic growth, types of careers, old Rotarian virtues, all of these were being markedly affected by this. There are other characteristics of the revolution that probably were less important, but still important enough. There was a revolution in music, which was made possible by the invention of the electronic transistor, which permitted musical amplification and experimentation that was never possible before. And it was aided by a few highly talented people, such as the Beatles. Revolution in style, in dress, in length of hair, in lifestyles, as it was termed, the time of the flower children, the communes, the hippies, the Haight-Ashbury crowd over in San Francisco. Now, all of these were related to the attitudes toward the Vietnam War in particular, and to foreign policy in general, especially to foreign policy having to do with intervention or commitment. Gone in the 60s, the late 60s, was this original Kennedy challenge of pay any price, bear any burden, and so on. The great lingering question here, I should say, is the one the historians have yet to address, is would this cultural revolution have been the same, or would it have been different, if there had been no Vietnam War? The Cultural Revolution very deeply affected the war, but was the opposite also true? Is it quite possible we would have had this Cultural Revolution if there had been no Vietnam War at all? That is something, as I say, historians continue to wrestle with, and there isn't still, at least, any certain answer. All right, that's the backdrop, the kind of context that you have to keep in mind that this was going on here, and Berkeley was the very heart of the eye of the storm in this. This is what was going on in terms of shaping public opinions of people in the United States toward the Vietnam War. Time of flux and change, in which everything was sort of up for grabs. All right, now to focus then more clearly or more directly on the question of public opinion and the war. The general opinion on the war was the result, I should say, of seven major factors, which are, first, of course, the hard events of the war itself. It is the battles fought, the bombs dropped, the death and the destruction. This obviously is a major source of shaping public opinion. Second was the apparently interminable nature of the war, that it went on and on and on, month after month, year after year. And in part this was a function of its complexity and the unique qualities that it seemed to have that made it difficult to understand. World War II, by comparison, would seem relatively elementary in understanding what was going on or who was doing what to whom. Part of this was the lack of logic and developments, the logic being that the United States should win the war very quickly. And this was not happening, and it was puzzling on all sides as to why this was. Beyond this was the apparent inability of the situation ever to become decisive. You couldn't lose, you couldn't win, it just sort of mumbled on and on. Another characteristic of this interminable nature was the interpretation, or the lack of interpretation, of this phenomena, explaining it by the mass media and by the academic community. I think, in truth, they were as puzzled as anybody else as to why this was. Instead, there was a kind of focus on a few strands and bits of development, but nothing that was sort of a broad canvas treatment. There was also the sort of seductive quality of the trivial and the transitory event for those who did the interpreting. They would spend enormous amounts of time explaining things that in the long run you realized didn't make any difference one way or the other. It seemed important at the time, but didn't. There was also a lack of symmetry or balance in reporting and in scholarly study between the two sides. And this was primarily a reason because the other side, North Vietnam, was inaccessible to journalists and to academics, basically. Three, there was a dearth of knowledge about Vietnam in general, largely because of journalistic and scholarly ignorance and a lack of preparation by the people who were doing this, inability to speak Vietnamese, for instance. And this created, in turn, a system that assigned journalists to cover the war and scholars to write about it who did not have the proper background or the proper education that was required to do this. And all of the subsequent inaccurate reporting, and particularly comparative reporting that followed, really stems from this essential ignorance. Fourth, there were, as a factor, the normal vested political interests in the United States and elsewhere, in Europe, for example, where the war was made a political football. Now, this is very common. It's done in everywhere in almost every event, every national event. The tendency in this case, in domestic political infighting, to treat the war as the cause of all social ills, and whose ending, therefore, would be a panacea. This is very much true of many of the race problems we had, economic problems, the notion that the reason for these somehow where it was the Vietnam War, and the ergo ending the war would solve these problems, which it did not. There was great utility of the war for foreign leaders, not only those who were hostile to the United States, but many more who used it to serve transitory or parochial interests. I'll say more about that when we deal with Europe and European attitudes and positions on the war. There was, five, the failure, there are shortcomings or mismanagement of and by the American and the South Vietnamese governments to explain their case, but explain it very plausibly, or to explain it with much integrity and sort of candor. Six, there was the temper of the age, which I've already alluded to, the Cultural Revolution. This was a time of, for the United States, of domestic troubles, of racial, demographic, economic, ecological upheaval. It was a moment in history that saw the rise of the irrational, the advent of the anti-hero, the decline of patriotism, and the emergence of what, at least to me, was a strange youth culture. Seven, finally, let me say a bit more about this, was the factor of Hanoi's Dick Van, or action among the enemy program. Now, the Dick Van program, I think we've talked about this somewhat in the opening days, but let me sort of refresh your memory on it. The Dick Van program operated among the enemy wherever possible, which meant not only adjacent to the battlefield in Vietnam, but on the other side of the world. As part of the Dao Chan strategy, it sought to do battle with the Americans on their home ground, not with guns, but with weapons of words and perceptual obfuscation, primarily, I would say, by throwing sand into the eyes of the world. Hanoi's memory was that the Vietnam War was helped to a great deal to shape French perception and contributed mightily to the victory that was achieved in the Viet Minh War, if not actually delivering it. Not everybody in Hanoi believed this, but many fairly prominent, powerful people did. The Dick Van program among Americans operated on two levels, one strategic and one tactical. The strategic purpose was to shape American perceptions so as to convince them that victory in Vietnam was impossible and therefore undermine support of the war at home as well as within American diplomacy worldwide. Tactical use was what has been termed power nullification, as to nullify the power that the United States had, primarily by seeking to use this device to limit American response, inhibit the full use of American military capability. The important thing to understand about this Dick Van phenomenon really is that it is a communicational effort to restructure the semantic environment. It's an effort to alter perception by linguistically channeling thought. The wartime statements made by Hanoi were not, generally speaking, a tissue of lies. Unlike fascist propaganda, with its calculatedly big lie technique, there is a truth in the Hanoi statements, providing you accept its definition of terms and worldview. The overall calculation of this Action Among the Enemies campaign was to present the United States and Americans with a kind of single, unified image of North Vietnam as a tough, perhaps sometimes ruthless, but essentially attractive society, peopled by highly motivated, incorruptible nationalists dedicated to the cause of justice, peace, democracy, possibly unification, but even in the case of unification, a cause that's entirely domestic, defensive, and threatening no one, or at least no one outside of Vietnam's borders. So inherent in this image is the assertion that the struggle in Vietnam and the war itself was political, and the use of mass military might, such as airstrikes and bombings, was illegitimate. All military use was illegitimate, except, quote, defensive measures by, quote, the people. And therefore, all military force, by definition, was terror, repression, or war crime. Now, the doctrinal framework of this campaign is the general, broad, psychological dimension of war. This war, any war that you care to name. The psychological dimension can be reduced sort of crudely to two elements, two basic assertions. One, certainty of victory. Two, monopolization of virtue. Certainty of victory. Each side in every war says we are certain that we are that the victory is certain to go to the just side, or the righteous side, or the deserving side, or in the old days, God's side. And that side is our side. Other side would say exactly the same thing. Both sides would also say, would in effect claim a monopoly of virtue. We are the good guys and you are the bad guys. And therefore that means you spend a great deal of time vilifying the enemy and a good deal of time praising yourself. Now, in every war in history, each side has employed, fully or half-heartedly, with or without success, these two notions. Each has communicated these ideas to the enemy and within its own camp. So until the rise of the Dao Chan strategy, this psychological effort was regarded only as an adjunct, and the clear understanding was that the battle would be the payoff, that what happened in combat would be the decisive factor. The Vietnamese communists were really the first to break with that assumption and the principle that the primary test must be military combat. They realized, dimly at first and then with increasing clarity, that it might be possible to achieve a change of venue, a change of the place of the war, and determine its outcome off the battlefield. So the real genius, I would say, of Dao Chan strategy in this sense is not simply that it updates the old notion of divide and conquer. Each side in every war attempts to split the unity of the other side, divide and conquer, but that it used what you might call the judo principle of the enemy's the weight of the enemy's philosophic system used against him. It works, therefore, best against a democracy and least well against totalitarians or fanatics. It agrees with the enemy that victory will go to the just because justice must triumph. But it does not paint the enemy side with a brush that tars all. Rather, the enemy is an abstraction, his unjust and misled leadership. And that means, practical terms, only a few individuals. So the normal polarization of wartime, good guys against the bad guys, the view from in both camps, is denied. Over and over it is asserted, asserted by Hanoi to anyone that they could get to, anybody that would listen to them, the notion, and particularly the population in the United States, we are not your enemy. The enemy is the unjust person who wishes to pursue an unjust war, and surely you are not one of those. Thus we stand not for victory, but for justice. Ho Chi Minh's famous poem, "We shall win, and so shall you." The strategy does not seek to monopolize virtue then, but to share it. Although it declares itself to be a virtue without flaw, it acknowledges that virtue also exists in the enemy camp, opposing camp, and it stigmatizes and vilifies only selectively. It did this very carefully in South Vietnam, in dividing the good guys and the bad guys from the South Vietnam population, did the same thing in the United States, singling out individual. In Vietnam, it was the landlords and the generals. In the United States, it was Robert McNamara and the successive presidents. Have to vilify the top man, I think. You can't get around that. You can't maintain he's okay, it just doesn't know what he's doing. So what this means is the Vietnam War, in this sense, becomes a kind of test of virtue. The outsider, the bystander looking at this, is presented with a kind of idealized picture of one side, and he can see on the other side, because he doesn't have access to it, and on the other side, he sees the errors, the shortcomings, follies, and so on. This is a case where reality stands very little chance against image. Now, the only reason this worked or did not work better at a strategic level, let me come to that, is simply that most Americans didn't pay too much attention to it. They weren't really recipients of it. Quite a few were, though, I think more than we cared to believe. In tactical terms, these Dick Van techniques were used to vilify, particularly throughout the world and in diplomatic circles, were used to vilify American use of air power. During the 1965-68 air war period, and again during the so-called Christmas bombings of 1972, very major Dick Van campaigns were cranked up to force cessation of these air attacks. Horrible pictures of churches being bombed and children being in hospitals. The air war, the results of air war at its very worst. I think Hanoi officials today generally believe, probably incorrectly, that the 1968, March 1968, halt in airstrikes was the result of their Dick Van efforts. Now, of course, such actions, you understand, are perfectly legitimate. If Hanoi can achieve its strategic goal with Dick Van techniques, if it can force the Americans through propaganda devices to stop bombing, who can say nay? It's a perfectly legitimate way of doing it. Nor was the effort mere pretense or sham. The Hanoi leaders worked very diligently to build a favorable image, a genuinely favorable image. They altered policy in the name of Dick Van. They shot looters and purged cadres. They refused alliances. They ordered military offensives or lulls, all for the sake of the perception. So this was one of the major factors in shaping American public opinion. But let me stress, I am not advancing any kind of simple-minded devil theory that Hanoi manipulated world public opinion of itself in the war and therefore is to be given the credit with all of the dissent, the criticism, the opposition that subsequently developed in the United States. That would be giving Dick Van far more credit than it is due. How you measure this exactly is something I don't think there is any. I'll come to this later in the problem of measuring public opinion under far simpler conditions. But there can be no doubt, I think, that this Dick Van program of vilifying particularly the air war, did succeed in the United States to the extent of causing many people to believe that the airstrikes as a form of war were somehow more horrible and more brutal than other forms of warfare that was going on in the Mideast at the same time, for instance. It caused many people to use a kind of double standard, that is, the demolition of a bridge in South Vietnam by a sapper team was somehow not nearly as bad as a bridge being hit by an airstrike in North Vietnam. The critic for My Lai became an apologist for Doc Son or for Hue. The really ironic part is that many of these perceptions that were shaped will dissolve on any kind of even casual inspection. Many of the assertions defy elementary logic, yet they endured throughout the war and they continue now, threaten to become the orthodox of history. I'm not sure why this is, but much of this turned very skeptical, normally skeptical newsmen, turned them into very credulous people. It made careful scholars more or less indifferent to fact, and it blinded what you would think are honorable men to what, in fact, is immorality. As I say, we're still trying to measure how much effect this really has. I don't mean to oversell this. The mere purpose of going on at some length of this is to simply tell you that this was a there were many factors that shaped public opinion, and one of them certainly is important, at least as the other seven, other six, was this Dick Vaughan program. Any comments on this or questions? Yes. Well, they did it through mass media, radio, pictures, motion pictures, did it through visitors, third parties, people who came either to Vietnam or people who were contacted in their own home country. It was, I don't like to use the word propaganda or public relations, but the techniques that were used were, on both sides, were approximately this. It was presenting information and getting people to look at the war in a certain way, and to do this really by any way that you could. Now, I think in the case of North Vietnamese, they used social movements far more than they used mass media. They worked through organizations. And their most success, of course, was in the bloc world, I mean the socialist world. I've been struck by, in talking to Soviets who are well educated, how many myths and absolute untruths they have bought, and bought not just factually, but whole historical interpretations. And I can only conclude that that is a result of some very successful efforts by the Vietnamese working with the media in the Soviet Union primarily. I know, I don't want to get off on this, I know a woman scholar of the Vietnam who is a very careful scholar generally, but she has she has this attitude about how the Vietnamese have always been picked on by everybody and they've never deserved it. And she said, you know, everybody invades them and everybody hurts them. And I said, for example, well, the Chinese, of course, but Thailand, you know, they've invaded Vietnam three times in the last 30 years. I say, really? When was the last time? Well, during World War II, I guess it was, when they invaded and took away those two provinces. I said, that was in Cambodia. Well, whatever. And I said, well, let me get this straight. You're saying that for 2,000 years, the Vietnamese have been pilloried and hurt and invaded and punished and hit on by all of their neighbors, and they've never done anything at all to deserve this. And she said, yes, that's what I'm saying. And I say, I don't think any Vietnamese that I know would say that. It's just shaping a perception that's hard to measure, and you're not sure exactly how people came by it, but it's... I give Dick Vaughan a very great deal of credit for it. Yes.
I'd maybe give some partial answer, having been here at the time, that probably much more effective than photographs, particularly.
Also came back with this non-polarized. See, that was the treatment they got in Hanoi, was we are not your enemy. And this is not the way, normally, in warfare, that things are. Now, in North and South Vietnam, they were much more polarized, I think the perceptions. And they did not have the Dick Vaughan action among the enemy in South Vietnam was less designed to shape perceptions in terms of good guy, bad guy, and it was more inclined to foster the attentiste spirit. As they would say to the people in Saigon, we're not bothering you, and they didn't bother them. To the Americans in Vietnam, they said, we're not bothering you. As indeed they could have. I mean, there was never any assassination program or kneecapping or, sniping at American civilians or so on. Could have been. And smart on the part of the... I mean, now in the Mideast, of course, that's... as a former, Foreign Service officer, I wonder why it is it never occurred to us that we would be in any danger, and we never were. And now, if you're in the Foreign Service, my God, you're a target for everybody. even in Italy, you can get kneecapped. Well, in the Mideast is a classic example. PLO ought to take a lesson from this. This is the way to do it. You don't do it by blowing up 707s and kidnapping people off of cruise ships and so on. All right, let me pass on now to the mass media in the war. Let me begin by making a few remarks about journalism in general in the U.S. before and in the early years of the war. Journalism itself was in a state of incipient revolution in the years running up to the Vietnam War. Objective journalism in the old style, the five W's and an H, who, what, when, where, why, and how, that was pretty much destroyed by Senator Joseph McCarthy. The way journalists worked in the past, you cover a story, you go in out and you answered those questions basically. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. And then came McCarthy, who said, I have in my hand here a list of 21 known card-carrying communists in the U.S. State Department. Okay, objective journalism is that you report that. It also requires that you say to the senator, can I have the list to check these people out? And he says, no, I can't do that now, maybe later. And so then it requires you to call the State Department and find, is this true or not? And they say, how the hell do we know? We don't have the list either. We got 15,000 people here, and he says 21 of them are communists, and we don't know whether this is true or not. So. That caused journalists, I mean, I'm not putting it all in McCarthy's, but the notion that you could manipulate the press by using their self-constrained limitations, by asserting something was true, and they were obliged under the way it was done to report this, even though they knew it wasn't true, and then try later to prove that it wasn't true. This is the so-called marketplace of ideas, and then didn't work. So there began an internal revolution within American journalism, saying this approach just doesn't work anymore. We've got to go beyond the five W's and an H. So then began a series of developments that began with sort of interpretative journalism that sort of moved along to what was called impressionistic journalism, that moved along to what was called investigative reporting journalism. Interpretative journalism was the idea that you don't just give who, what, when, where, why, and how, but you interpret what it means. And then that was found not to be completely acceptable because it didn't carry the texture, the quality of it, so you developed the notion of impressionistic journalism. The sense of it. This was not all media. The New Yorker magazine did it. Mary McGrory, Norman Mailer, some of the better, bigger named journalists and writers used it to very good effect. Then it was on to investigative reporting, Woodward and Bernstein type. And now, I guess you would say, maybe to the final illogical extreme of tabloid television, of what's his name, Gerardo Riviera and Morton Downey. Last time I saw him, he got hit on the nose with a chair, broke his nose. I don't know what kind of reporting that really is, but all right, that's so much for the kind of general run up to the mass media. In your reader, there is these two basic perceptions of the press in Vietnam. The press as a molder of public opinion and the press as a mirror of public opinion. So let me just tick these two basic perceptions off very quickly. The press as molder. This perception holds that the press, the mass media in America, distorted the nature, the significance, and the course of the Vietnam War. It did so deliberately, the print press sending to Vietnam ill-prepared correspondents who produced simplistic explanations for complex situations, the audiovisual media with their proclivity for treating news as entertainment, employing the test not of significance but of melodrama. The press also distorted inadvertently, particularly television, which is such an overwhelmingly powerful medium that it cannot help but distort everything that it reports. In any event, this distortion destroyed the singleness of national purpose that is required by any country to fight a war. It tied the hands of the country's leaders. It convinced the enemy that he need not compromise, but should continue to hang on, or eventually the Americans would force themselves out of the war. Since the war, let me add, this press as molder thesis has sharpened somewhat. Those who hold it now, make this argument now, offer this chain of logic. War, they say, is a test of willpower, of determination, of staying power. The press in this process of of whether there is or is not determination is not a transmission valve. It cannot be. It is a chief factor in the question of this determination. If it portrays the war as stalemate, as endless, as hopeless, then the Americans automatically are going to want to throw in the towel. If it portrays the war, if it had portrayed the war as winnable, then the Americans would have been willing to hang on, and the Viet Cong and Hanoi would have changed its strategy. It's a sort of modification. All right, the counter perception to this, or the major competing perception, is the press as mirror. And it holds that the press in a democracy is but one element of a broader equation of public opinion, that its influence in shaping basic attitudes is greatly exaggerated because it mirrors public opinion far more than it molds it. Much more important in forming beliefs are national leadership, social institutions such as the family, the school, the church, economic groups, and social movements, as well, as, of course, as personal psychology and the actual events that are happening. This is the hard news of history. Public opinion in America in the 1960s underwent radical change, not with just respect to Vietnam or foreign affairs, but to virtually every sector of American culture. Vietnam, in effect, was a victim of this changed set of attitudes. The press did not cause this to happen. At best, it merely hastened or exacerbated the change that came. Now, it's very commonplace since the war to blame the press for its outcome. Military historians and writers are particularly prone to do this. I have some negative things to say about the press in general, but I don't honestly feel that you can blame it to very much of an extent to the way the war turned out. Again, it's a judgment that history is still going to make. It is no doubt that the press, the journalists that arrived in Saigon, were ill-prepared for their task. They arrived without training or background in what they were to report on, and they were, as a result, cultural ignoramuses. With few exceptions, none ever spoke the language. Very few journalists I ever knew who had read a history of Vietnam. They saw the Vietnam society in South Vietnam as a kind of background to the war. But they were there to cover the war, and that's all they needed to know how to do. Unfortunately for them, I would say, it was not that kind of a war. You needed very much to know the cultural context of that kind of a war if you were going to report it. So there were two basic types of journalists in Vietnam, or the old line war correspondents and the who'd come up from, had covered World War II and Korea and were very experienced covering those kind of wars, but not very experienced in covering the kind of war that was Vietnam. And then the investigative reporter, Woodward and Bernstein type of reporter, adversarial, confrontational, who in their own way were no more equal to the task than were the online war correspondents. But I really felt sorry for them more than, I mean, particularly the ones on the scene. It really wasn't their fault that they were ill-prepared. It was the fault of their employers and the people that sent them there. I don't know if I ever told you the story of Joe Freed, was the one that was a New York Daily News reporter. This is the biggest paper in America in terms of circulation. And he was about 5 foot high, and he was a typical feisty New Yorker, and a good reporter, really. The first time I ever met him was in the middle of the Buddhist burnings and the Buddhist self-immolations and so on. And he'd been stationed in India, and somebody had given him my name as somebody to see when you got to Vietnam. So he rushed into my office, and he was always in a hurry, and always stood up, and said, "I just got into town. I got a file in about an hour. Will you explain to me what are these Buddhists out here in the street doing? I just saw one of them burn himself up. What the hell is that all about?" Well, you know, your first reaction is sort of throw him out of the office. 20 minutes, he wants me to tell him the history of Vietnam, the history of the war. But the second reaction I had was to feel sorry for him. I mean, it wasn't really his fault that he'd got thrown into this maw. So I did, you know, what I could, and I never did see the story he filed. I don't think I really wanted to see it. But he then was there, and by the, you know, these were in the early 60s, and by the end of the war, he was still there, and it was really one of the best journalists. He'd sort of educated himself, very hard-working guy, and